From WVUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. 7 NFL teams will vie tomorrow for a scant 3 remaining postseason spots. Which will it be? The certain answer. Well, maybe a probable answer. Okay, a possible answer is just ahead on Only a Game. Also, Rose Bowl Stadium gets a new arrangement and a conversation with author Randy Roberts about the life and times of fabled boxer Joe Louis. Also ahead, former NBA star Antoine Walker engineers his comeback by a bankruptcy court and the basketball court.
Walker has turned his life around. He's trying to get back where he was before. Can't do nothing but respect that. He comes to practice every day. He works hard. He sat down and talked with a lot of us. He's a great teammate.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The long and wounding road leading to the NFL playoffs ends tomorrow, at which point Brett Favre can rethink his plan to retire, and the remaining slots in the postseason will be filled. Joining me now to discuss the teams likely to go deep into the playoffs, and at least one that should probably be ashamed to be included in them, is national columnist for CBSSports.com, Greg Doyle. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Good.
Maybe we can make this conversation short and sweet by ignoring 31 NFL teams and stating the obvious. The New England Patriots are going to easily win the Super Bowl, right?
Oh, absolutely. Just like a couple years ago, they were 16-0, and then they won two games in the playoffs, and they were 18-0. I remember how they won that Super Bowl by like, wait a minute.
That trophy's missing from the case. Somebody must have taken it.
Here's what's going to happen. Whoever wins the NFC West, that team is going to the Super Bowl. It's almost a no-brainer. And they might even win the darn thing.
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
There are two AFC teams still alive that haven't yet made the postseason. Will Indianapolis or Jacksonville sneak in at the end of the regular season to nab that last spot?
Well, it's got to be the Colts. That said, it'll probably not be, but on paper, it's got to be. They're playing at home. Jacksonville's on the road. The Colts have Peyton Manning at quarterback. The Jaguars don't have their quarterback, David Girardi's hurt. Also, their best running back, Maurice Jones-Drew, is at best going to play injured, might not play at all. So, on paper, there's no possible way the Colts don't get into the playoffs. That said, the Jaguars are going to probably win this whole Super Bowl.
Nobody seems to talk much about the Kansas City Chiefs. Is that justifiable?
Well, with good reason. It's Kansas City. Matt Castle's their quarterback. I realize he's had a very good year. If it weren't for Tom Brady, he might even be the MVP of the league this year. But at the end of the day, he's still Matt Castle, and that's still the Kansas City Chiefs. And until they actually do something important, like win a playoff game, I'm going to write them off.
Well, which other AFC teams should we be talking about as the playoffs approach?
I love whoever wins the AFC North, and even if one of them comes out of there as a wild card team, the Ravens and the Steelers. They've got what normally is what gets it done in the playoffs. They've got mean SOB defenses. They've got a very solid, if not brilliant, quarterback. They've got good running games. Those are two teams, either team. I mean, they're mirror images of each other. Whichever one of those teams has the best road in terms of playing at home and playing maybe a friendly first-round game, look for that team to go a long way.
There's some uncertainty in the NFC where there are five teams fighting on week 17 to claim two more playoff spots. Which will they be?
Yeah, I'm going to go with the New York Giants just because that will set New York City's media world aflame. Because right now they've already decided that Tom Coughlin's going to be fired. And so if the Giants actually win week 17 and get to the playoffs and then even do some damage, then it'll cause those people to turn their heads upside down and go the other direction. And the reason I say that is that my version of Hades, and I've had this dream several times, is I wake up working in the New York City media market covering the New York Giants for one of those knucklehead newspapers. That is my idea of hell.
All right, now it is time to talk about the NFC West. Don't you love the fact that the winner of tomorrow's tilt between the 7-8 St. Louis Rams and the 6-9 Seattle Seahawks will take that division?
Yeah, what's a shame is that the Rams have one of the best rookie quarterbacks ever. Sam Bradford's numbers are right up there with anybody's. I mean, he's having a great year, and yet kind of like the Kansas City is still Kansas City. That's still the Rams. And the Rams did get blown out this year, 44-6. to Detroit. But I think there's a weird NFL tiebreaker here that you got to take into account. There's the Rams, there's the Seahawks, and there's also the 1962 Mets, and they're not sure which of those three teams will get into the playoffs now.
Greg, there's a sports cliche applicable in pretty much every sport, I think. Should the eventual NFC West champion enter the playoffs saying, with all sincerity, we're just happy to be here?
Actually, happy is the wrong word. Shocked. Use that same sentence and say, we're just shocked to be here. Yeah, we're shocked with you, Seahawks or Rams. We're shocked with you.
It would only be fair to mention that the NFC's other divisions are quite strong. Philly, Chicago, Atlanta, and New Orleans all look good at this point. Which ones do you see having strong postseasons?
I really like the Falcons. They've got this young quarterback, Matt Ryan, that just kind of knows how to win. And at that level, all those quarterbacks are really good. Michael Vick is no slouch either with Philadelphia. But Matt Ryan, his nickname is great. I love a good nickname. His nickname is Matty Ice. And here I am from Cincinnati, so Natty Ice. I know all about bad beer. He's a good quarterback. And they've got their coach, Michael Smith, has something going with him. He's got that kind of knucklehead edge to him. I like the Falcons.
We'd be remiss, albeit greatly relieved, not to talk about Brett Favre this week, so I have to ask, did he get off too easily with a $50,000 fine for, quote, refusing to cooperate with the league's investigation into charges that he had texted inappropriate pictures to a female reporter back when he was with the Jets?
I need the NFL to tell me how he refused, because to me that's an open-ended deal, and if he flat-out didn't give his phone over, that's a refusal. If he tells them, look, I'm sorry, that phone's gone, well, I guess technically he refused to help, but not really. So I need to know exactly how he refused. All I know is this, that you can't prove that he sent that picture, even if it came from his phone, even if it is his body part. You can't prove he did it. And I know this because I've got a ninth grader who's always text messaging with other people, and there's always an issue of, well, who sent that text message? You called me a name. I didn't do it. My brother got the phone in his hand. So there's always, you can never prove who sent it. So in some ways, he got off easy. I just need to know what that refusal to help was.
Favre could be playing in his last NFL game tomorrow. Should he leave the stadium with his head held high?
I'd hope he leaves the stadium with his nether regions covered up and not photographed. But, yeah, no, actually, no. You know, here's a guy that could have left on top last year. No, they didn't win Super Bowl, but he had statistically an incredible season. Chose to come back and really just push the envelope, push the odds. The odds did not work in his favor, obviously. His body gave up this year. Off the field, he had all kinds of issues. He's in a long line of guys. Joe Namath is one of them. Long line of guys that didn't know when to retire. I'm not sure anybody has left too late in the game and really damaged himself in every possible way more than Brett Favre has.
Greg Doyle is a national columnist for CBSSports.com, and he joins us here on Only a Game from time to time as well. Greg, thanks again.
Bill, thank you for having me.
Today's Rose Bowl pits Wisconsin against Texas Christian. The 90,000-plus fans who will pack the Rose Bowl will be among the last to experience the stadium in its current state. Crews will soon begin a $152 million renovation of the municipally owned facility, which has hosted two Olympics, five Super Bowls, men's and women's World Cup matches, and almost 90 Rose Bowl games. KPCC's Susan Vallett reports.
On a sunny, warm December day, the Rose Bowl's dusty pink seats and aluminum benches are empty as crews work on the field. Sue Mossman of the historic preservation group Pasadena Heritage points out the changes the renovation will bring.
So this will be more elliptical, and then they will put a hedge back about where this wall is, which it used to originally have a hedge.
The stadium will get new plumbing and electrical and other infrastructure upgrades like wider tunnels that won't induce claustrophobia in fans moving to the seating area. There will be a 1940s replica scoreboard, too. Mossman says the renovation will keep the historic feel of the Rose Bowl, which hosted its first game in 1922.
It was designed at a time when football was just reaching a peak of attention in local communities and on a national level. This was becoming maybe the second great American pastime, was American-style football.
Mossman says the Rose Bowl is the last best-preserved football stadium of its kind and of its time.
So it has a history, it has a patina, it has a whole legacy that goes with the physical structure. Is all about the history of the country, football as a sport, college football as something that communities embrace and endorse and live for. all of that goes with this place.
At UCLA's last 2010 home game against USC, the stadium is a sea of true blue and gold, with the end zones filled with USC's crimson and gold. A lot of the fans here haven't even heard of the renovation plans, but those in on the game plan generally like the idea. Rose Bowl general manager Daryl Dunn says it's a unique situation.
We are a college football stadium and we don't have alumni. Typically, a college football stadium, a big renovation, the alumni are a big part of it. So it's hard. The track record are municipally owned stadiums with college football as their anchor tenants have died. So we're going against that trend.
Dunn says they would be taking a gamble if they didn't renovate, especially with the possibility of an NFL team moving to LA in the next few years.
If a new stadium comes to Los Angeles, which we anticipate will happen, certainly, you know, that won't be $150 million. That'll probably be over $1 billion, and they'll have every bell and whistle known to mankind. But this place is, you know, a mecca for college football. And college football is a very strong, healthy sport. And that's what we're embracing.
It's a strategy also embraced by many here today, like Gene Wiechek.
Rose Bowl is just such an icon. I mean, I've grown up coming here for, you know, sporting events like UCLA, concerts, you know, seen the Rolling Stones here a few times over the years. I mean, it's just an icon here in this area, and you want to see it maintained and updated and kept in good shape. So I'm excited about it. I'm glad they're doing it.
Pasadena City Manager Michael Beck says the renovation will give the city some leverage in the stadium market. He says local officials are worried if they don't do anything, Pasadena will lose the Rose Bowl in the next decade or two.
And the question is, would the same situation that happened in Florida happen in Pasadena? And that Orange Bowl, they had an NFL team, the Dolphins, that left the stadium, and then ultimately the university left the stadium, and there was nothing left, and then at the end the stadium ended up being destroyed.
Beck says for Pasadena's Rose Bowl, the window of opportunity for renovating is now, because the stadium was able to qualify for Build America Bonds, a federal stimulus program that gives borrowers a rebate on part of the interest rate. That saves several million dollars. The renovation will also quadruple the number of luxury boxes. Stadium officials say that'll help keep them in the game by giving them a steady stream of income for future upkeep. It's a plan that they hope will be a touchdown for what they call the granddaddy of college football stadiums. For Only a Game, I'm Susan Vallett in Pasadena, California.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The Burlington, Wisconsin Liars Club holds a competition each year to determine its champion liar, and that's the truth. It's been ever thus, or at least it's been thus since 1929 when the club began. It's also true that entries submitted to the Liars Club must be short. Among the runners-up this year was Daryl Lockwood, whose lie read, "My neighbor's scarecrow was so good that the crows brought back the corn they stole last year." Mr. Lockwood and the other 500 or so liars vying for the crown were undone by David Mills, whose lie ran as follows. "I almost had a psychic girlfriend, but she left me before we met." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, former NBA star Antoine Walker looks to get the shimmy back in his game and his game back to the big time. But first, here to discuss the NBA approximately 39% of the way through the fleeting regular season is Kevin Hench of FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
The Spurs are an astonishing 28-4. Did you see San Antonio starting the season at such a torrid pace?
Certainly not, given that a year ago when we had this conversation, I said the Spurs were too old to make any noise in the Western Conference playoffs, and I was right a year ago. I don't see how the same cast of characters is 28-4 on pace for 72 wins with no infusion of youth, really. It's the same Duncan, Ginobili, Parker trio that was too old last year, which means Greg Popovich should get that Coach of the Year award right now.
Do you think the Lakers are getting just a little bit, you know, mopey thinking about the Spurs and, for that matter, about the Dallas Mavericks and the Utah Jazz, both of which have also been impressive?
And let me tell you, people out here in Los Angeles are panicking. It is full-on panic in L.A. because their birthright of winning the NBA championship every year is being threatened. I think the Lakers are mopey because they can't believe how long this irrelevant 82-game regular season is until they can get to the games that matter. Mm. I think the Lakers are going to win the Western Conference. They're going to play the Heat in the finals. I'm not backing off that. I just think the Lakers have a hard time getting motivated for the Milwaukee Bucks, who blew them out at the Staples Center last week. Come playoff time, I don't know if you've heard of this coach, Phil Jackson.
Yeah.
Tends to have his teams ready come playoff time. I think Laker fans need to take the finger off the panic button a little bit.
There has been recent talk about the NBA contracting, and as I look at the Western Conference standings, I'm wondering if anybody would notice if the NBA teams in Sacramento, Minnesota, and Memphis were to just go away. What do you think?
Oh, man! What about Kevin Love? It's the story of the NBA. No,
they'd have a dispersal draft. It's not an issue.
I know. I think NBA contraction, probably a good idea, probably won't happen. There are a lot of these cities. New Orleans is another one. They just, whether the teams are good or bad, they just can't generate that much interest in some of these outposts, these remote outposts of the NBA. The league is kind of distilled down now to about 8 teams that people care about that they know are going to be in the respective conference semis. And these other teams, these other cities are just kind of playing out the string. I think contraction's a good idea, which is why it definitely will not happen.
In the East, the Boston Celtics are holding on to the best conference record, but given concerns about Kevin Garnett and the Celtics' aging front line, what do you think? Do they hold on to that position for long?
Not for long. I think it was a foregone conclusion at the beginning of the season that the Celtics had a lot of miles on those tires and would have to kind of rest their players throughout the season in order to be ready for the playoffs. Now, good luck telling Kevin Garnett to take it easy, because obviously when he's on the court, he's a madman. He only knows one way to play. So it's no surprise that he tweaked his lower leg, according to the Celtics, and he'll only be out for 2 weeks. But all these little injuries, Shaq has to take a couple weeks off here and there. Jermaine O'Neal has to take a month off here and there. The Rondo injury obviously has hurt them quite a bit too. I think it's going to add up to the Heat passing them for the best record in the conference, but the Celtics have proven over the years, especially in the playoffs, that they can go on the road and win, so I don't think it's as critical to the Celtics that they have the best record in the conference. What is critical is that they have those guys healthy come playoff time.
I gather, given your prediction for the finals, that you say the Heat has probably found themselves at this point.
I would say so. They looked awesome on Christmas Day, and while it did take a little while for LeBron James and Dwayne Wade to figure it out, Dwayne Wade going for 40 and 45 in his last two games, I think he's figured out how to play with LeBron. They are punishing teams. I'm not backing off that prediction. When everybody else was panicking, when the Heat were slow coming out of the gates, I said, no way. That team is too good, too talented. They will be in the finals. However, I love what the Orlando Magic has done in the last 2 weeks. Addition by subtraction, getting rid of Rashard Lewis and getting rid of Vince Carter and letting J.J. Redick have some of those minutes. Addition by subtraction, even if they hadn't added Hedo Turkoglu, who played his best basketball of his career in Orlando, and Jason Richardson, a legitimate shooter. Now, the Gilbert Arenas thing I still have questions about, but he seems to be handling his supporting role. I think the Magic are suddenly a very scary team.
You spoke of Christmas Day, and there were 5 games on Christmas Day, which prompted much sarcasm from Lakers head coach Phil Jackson and from Orlando Magic skipper Stan Van Gundy, but the games delivered record TV ratings, I'm told. So is it safe to say that by about 2012, all 30 teams will play on Christmas?
Who knew that the war on Christmas would be led by the National Basketball Association. It's crazy, Bill. Well, you know what? People are home. People, you know, they have a good product. I don't mind having the TV on all day long, watching the Celtics blow a lead against the Magic and the Heat blow out the Lakers. It's a good way to spend a Christmas day. You maybe have to keep the sound down, but I have no problem with having the NBA on morning, noon, and night.
Maybe there should be an NBA Winter Classic like the NHL has. What do you think about outdoor games on New Year's Day?
Well, as a shooter, Bill, I always hated playing outdoors. It's a depth perception issue, and I know Ray Allen would be against it.
Well, and then there's the wind.
The wind, the no depth, occasionally some sun in your eyes.
Kevin Hench covers the NBA for FoxSports.com. You can hear his podcast with John Sally, Spider, and the Henchmen on iTunes and AdamCarolla.com. Kevin, thanks very much and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Bill. Happy New Year to you. Have a great 2011.
The list of competitive, hungry, hardworking players in the NBA's Development League is long, but the list of D-League players who were also former NBA All-Stars and champions, really short. Only a Game's Doug Trevoux reports.
Scan the roster of the Idaho Stampede, and one name stands out. Yes, the Antoine Walker, who joined the team early last month, is the same Antoine Walker that played in the NBA from 1996 to 2008. The three-time All-Star earned approximately $110 million during his career, but after a recent morning shoot-around before a D-League game in Portland, Maine, it's fair to ask whether he has to share a hotel room on the road.
I'm a veteran. I get my own room. So far, I don't know. They never know what the situation is, but they've been good to me. I've been able to get my own room. But you do have roommates, though.
Walker's unlikely to wind up in the Basketball Hall of Fame, but he's in an exclusive club that includes names like Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Magic Johnson, Isaiah Thomas, and Michael Jordan. They all played on championship teams in college and the NBA. Walker and his Kentucky teammates won the NCAA national title in 1996. 10 years later, he earned an NBA championship ring with the Miami Heat. Idaho Stampede head coach Randy Livingston says Walker's resume makes him an instant leader in the D-League.
That experience is invaluable. Having someone that can be your voice on the court, someone that the younger guys can look up to because they know he's been there, you know, is important. Sometimes during shoot around or during practice, we give him some time on the court where he can share some of his knowledge of the game with those guys.
Walker played his last NBA game with Minnesota in February 2008. He started the next season with the Memphis Grizzlies, but was waived without appearing in any games. Walker believes he could have continued playing.
Just sit at home, left the game. I felt like I left the game not on my own merit. I felt like I had to take a break from the game, get myself together.
But Walker didn't exactly get himself together when he stopped playing basketball. In January 2009, he was arrested in Miami for suspicion of drunk driving. That summer, Walker was arrested in Nevada for allegedly bouncing checks in three Las Vegas casinos. Walker's paid off some of the debt, but he's scheduled to stand trial in May and still owes the casinos approximately $800,000. He says his attorneys are working to resolve the case.
I'm in court right now, just trying to figure out, you know, what I owe, what it's going to be. Right now, I don't know where it's going to lead me. Hopefully, in the next few months, I'll figure that out. I think I have proper representation behind me that's handling the situation. So I really, honestly, I don't even worry about it right now.
But there are other financial concerns. Despite his massive NBA contracts and additional endorsement money, Walker has filed for bankruptcy. He lists $4.3 million in assets against $12.7 million in liabilities. Walker admits gambling was a factor, but has repeatedly cited bad real estate investments in his hometown of Chicago as the primary source of his debt. Walker also has other legal issues, including a civil lawsuit. His Stampede teammate, swingman Willie Jenkins, says when Walker came to Idaho, he was upfront about his problems.
Walker has turned his life around. He's trying to get back where he was before. Can't do nothing but respect that. He come to practice every day. He works hard. He's the first one or the last one to leave. He sat down and talked with a lot of us, explained to us his situation, which most people would try to hide. He explained it. He understands his mistakes. He put God first, and he's a great teammate.
off-court issues, 2+ years away from the game, and a slightly thicker 34-year-old body make it easy to forget the player Antoine Walker was when he left Kentucky after his sophomore season. Peter May is a writer for ESPNBoston.com and has covered the Celtics for 25 years. May says during his early years in Boston, the 6'9" forward was exciting to watch.
He was a terrific rebounder, especially an offensive rebounder. He was a great passer. He was a great finisher on offense. He wasn't that hot a shooter, but he could get the ball in the basket. But offensively, he was as versatile as anybody that's come into the Celtics in a long time with the potential that he had.
Williams looking, Antoine for the game. Got it! Off the glass with 1.2 on the clock. The Celtics are up by one.
That's Mike Gorman with the call on Fox Sports Net in 2002. During his career, Walker averaged more than 17 points, 7 rebounds, and 3 assists per game, but he could frustrate fans and coaches with poor shot selection and weak defense. And no conversation about Antoine Walker is complete without a mention of three-pointers. May says fans weren't thrilled when he started settling for that shot more and more often.
That really got people on him because he was 6'9", and they felt he should be, you know, playing down low and utilizing his quickness and his passing ability rather than kicking threes from every which way.
In the D-League, Walker's performance has been mixed. He airballed a foul shot in his first appearance for Idaho. But when the Stampede opened a mid-December road trip with a loss to the Maine Red Claws, Walker put on a show with 25 points and 8 rebounds in just 33 minutes. D-League crowds are the smallest audiences Walker's played in front of since high school. But Portland, Maine provided a homecoming of sorts. Ryan Garrity was one of more than 3,000 fans who came out for the game. Garrity lives in nearby Cape Elizabeth and says he and his friends were Walker fans during his days with the Celtics.
I'm 27 now. I've watched him since he got drafted, basically his whole career. As soon as I heard he was on Idaho, we looked for tickets.
The D-League's maximum salary is just over $25,000, so Walker's looking for a bigger paycheck. He played briefly in Puerto Rico in 2010 before being cut, but he's ruled out going overseas for now. With his years of service, a one-year minimum NBA contract would pay Walker more than $1.3 million. But can he really make it back to the NBA? Peter May says a 34-year-old, who was never known for his love of the treadmill and has a history of knee problems, will only get a shot in a perfect situation, and it's now or never.
I wouldn't be surprised to see Antoine get called up by somebody, kind of as a look just to see, is there anything left? Does he have anything left? He's not going to make any money staying in the D-League, and if he doesn't get a call up this year, I think it's pretty much going to be curtains for him.
Walker is probably the biggest star to enter the D-League, but he's not the oldest. 35-year-old Antonio Daniels joined the Texas Legends this season. Daniels also has a championship ring from San Antonio's 1999 title. Walker says after a long NBA career, it's inspiring to see D-leaguers working so hard trying to get where he and Daniels have already been.
It's very difficult. You know, I think guys, you know, you kind of mature into men, and, you know, they have families. Sometimes you have a kid. So it's very difficult to do, you know, for 8-9 months to play in the D-League and not make a lot of money. So I appreciate what these guys do and the work ethic that they put in. So you have to be sympathetic to that and understand it takes a lot.
Walker is a phone call away from joining an NBA team, but tonight he'll be back in Nevada, hoping for a little help from Lady Luck. Idaho's on a 5-game losing streak, and they're playing the Reno Bighorns. For Only a Game, I'm Doug Tribou.
You're listening to Only a Game. As we say goodbye to 2010, I'm inclined to look back in appreciation at the New Orleans Saints, Spain's national soccer team, the San Francisco Giants, and the UConn women's basketball team. The Saints didn't make everybody forget that New Orleans and environs were and still are the victims of neglect and broken promises, but they did give the team's fans a reason to get more and more excited as the NFL season progressed, and then, at the end, the Saints provided cause for celebration. This is something a Super Bowl winner will do. The triumph of the Spanish soccer team in last summer's World Cup was twofold. By outplaying with their patient, imaginative, and crisp passing game various opponents who were trying to beat them up to slow them down, Spain reminded a worldwide audience that elegant soccer can prevail. By winning the cup, the Spanish team put behind them a history of failures as inexplicable as it has been disappointing. The San Francisco Giants produced a similar achievement. For the most part, they had flailed in the wake of the Dodgers, darlings of Hollywood, ever since both teams changed coasts half a century ago. Long the tenants of cold and windy Candlestick Park, a grand and dependable source of stadium jokes, the Giants persevered through gloom of freezing nights and blustery afternoons, an earthquake, and the bloated Barry Bonds in his clubhouse recliner, before finally presenting their fans with a champion. And then there are the women of the last few editions of the basketball team over which Gino Auriemma has presided at the University of Connecticut. Their record winning streak, which ended at 90 games courtesy of Stanford on Thursday night, is not bad for women's basketball, as some have suggested. It is not bad for anybody except the teams Connecticut beat. In the context of sports and beyond, the streak is, by definition, good. One thing you're supposed to do in sports is you're supposed to try to win. You're supposed to do that whether you're male or female, and you're supposed to do it within the rules, which, as far as I know, the UConn women's program, unlike its men's counterpart, has done. So good on 'em, say I, and John Wooden's grandson maintains that Coach Wooden would have said the same, which should be good enough for those determined to downplay on gender grounds what the UConn women accomplished. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm with 3,000 professionals worldwide. Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon 11 speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com. This is NPR.
Should professional athletes serve as role models for children? According to Reg Bailey, chief executive of the Mothers Union charity in the UK, some pro soccer players serve that function and shouldn't. Mr. Bailey has in mind soccer stars Wayne Rooney, John Terry, and Ashley Cole, all of whom made the tabloids in 2010 for their extramarital adventures. Mr. Bailey, who is preparing a report for the Department of Education in London, said that the behavior of such, quote, sports people, as Rooney, Terry, and Cole, has had, quote, a clear influence on children's behavior and ideas of what is acceptable. This may explain why so many small boys in England have been purchasing gaudy jewelry, fast cars, and vacation villas. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with the author of a new biography of Joe Louis. But first, a conversation with the author of a book about Tom Brady, among other celebrated works. That would be Charlie Pierce. Happy New Year, Charlie.
Happy New Year, Bill. And Happy New Year to all of the Only a Game family, wherever they are.
The Tostitos Fiesta Bowl, not to be confused with the Tostitos BCS National Championship game, occurs today, as do other bowl games sponsored by such football-embracing business entities as Vizio, Progressive, Capital One, and Outback. Can you narrow the field to a couple of corporate outings? I'm sorry, a couple of football games worthy of our attention?
Actually, I think Wisconsin and TCU in the Rose Bowl is by far the most interesting game of New Year's Day this year. Because, number one, TCU is from outside the BCS cartel and spoiling for a fight. And Wisconsin seems to have been really angry at people since about the beginning of November, scoring between 60 and 80 points a game on folks. So that's going to be an intriguing collision. The other one that I find rather sort of intriguing is the Gator Bowl between Michigan and Mississippi State, because I'm not entirely sure those two teams have ever played each other.
Five suspended Ohio State football players apologized this week for selling their championship rings and other memorabilia and for accepting discounts at a tattoo parlor. All five of them have promised to come back next season to serve their suspensions, and in return, they will be allowed to travel to the Sugar Bowl on January 4th. How long before the first of them declares his eligibility for the NFL draft?
I would be amazed if at least three of these guys didn't play in the Sugar Bowl and then say, how can they make me go back to Columbus?
Well, they'll withhold their salary.
No, you can't. Hey. I think what they should all do is play in the Sugar Bowl and then go outside the stadium and sell their game jerseys on the sidewalk and then declare for the NFL draft. That way we could knock this entire preposterous, hypocritical structure that's been built up around this thing down.
It's been another tough week for Brett Favre. He failed his concussion test, and he was fined $50,000 by the NFL for not cooperating with the investigation into whether the quarterback had sent inappropriate photos to a former Jets employee. Would he have been fined more if he had cooperated?
Either something really wrong happened here or it didn't. It seems to be that the NFL is now fining him for not incriminating himself further. And he was also, and this is really wonderful because it sounds like he's under the disciplinary committees of the House of Commons. He says he's had, quote, a rebuke for not being candid. Namely, he lied to the investigators. Something very weird is going on here.
This week, Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell said, quote, we're becoming a nation of wussies. So was this because he feels Americans expect too much in terms of unemployment insurance, welfare, perhaps health care?
No, it was because they canceled the Sunday night game between the Eagles and Vikings that was supposed to be played the night of the blizzard that hit Philadelphia. What Ed doesn't seem to understand, and Ed, by the way, has a long, proud history as a jackass Philadelphia sports fan, long before he became governor of Pennsylvania or mayor of Philadelphia. What he doesn't seem to understand is that people would be leaving the game in 12 inches snow. These people have to get home. They don't come to the stadium and pitch a tent.
On Thursday night, the UConn women's basketball team's winning streak was broken at 90 games. Stanford finally came out on top 71-59. Did UConn coach Gino Auriemma have the right attitude at the press conference after his team's first loss in 2.5 seasons?
Yeah, I actually liked it. He said the losing stuff was getting really old. It's wonderful proof that there are certain rules about basketball that pertain to Biddy League basketball, all the way up to the NBA, all the way to women's basketball, men's basketball, it doesn't matter. When your best player stinks and the other team's best player has the game of her career, the team with the best player who had the game of their career is always going to win. Maya Moore had an awful night, and Jeanette Pollen from Stanford got 31 points and hit every big shot. And it was really a very entertaining last 10 or 15 minutes, which I have to confess is all I watched.
On Tuesday night, Duke's men's basketball team slipped by North Carolina Greensboro 108-62. This wouldn't bear mention except that the win allowed Duke head coach Mike Krzyzewski to assume second place on the list of winningest Division I head coaches. You care to enter the pool with a guess about when he will overtake Bob Knight?
Well, he's only 22 games behind him now, and I don't see Duke losing more than one or two games this season. So it's entirely possible he would do it, if not right before the NCAA tournament and sometime during it. This, of course, was also significant because he passed Dean Smith as longtime rival, the former coach of the University of North Carolina.
The NHL's Winter Classic game, originally scheduled for 1 o'clock this afternoon in Pittsburgh, has been rescheduled to 8 o'clock at night because of a forecast that calls for 80% to 100% chance of afternoon rain. So if hockey in the snow is nostalgic and fun, what is hockey in the rain?
Messy,
wet,
sloppy, useless. Why don't they just have the Winter Classic in Tampa some year out in the parking lot?
Oh, there's a plan.
Calgary plays a game outside every year anyway. Why can't that be the NHL's Winter Classic? Why can't every team have to go to Calgary and play it every year? It's a wonderful thing, by the way. I think it's a tremendous thing for the league. It's a huge television thing for them. It's an honor for the teams to play in it. But there are certain places where you can't play outdoors in January.
Ottawa Senator Ryan Shannon gave his wife a late Christmas present on Wednesday night. Charlie, he gave her a hockey puck. Right in her lap. I hope she wasn't hoping for a necklace or a toaster oven or something.
Oh, God. I mean, he took a shot, hit the crossbar, went up over the netting and landed in his wife's lap. And he said, jokingly, I think, that he was aiming at the Toronto Maple Leafs fan who was sitting next to her. I mean, what do you say to that except what are the odds?
Yeah, exactly. Go ahead. Do it again.
Yeah, do it. I dare you to do it again. Except I don't think his wife will go along with that.
In this world wherein it is often impossible to distinguish between sports and entertainment, which is more significant, that Jimmy Johnson has won his fourth consecutive Driver of the Year award, or that for the eighth year in a row, Dale Earnhardt Jr. has been voted NASCAR's most popular driver?
An interesting question. If you are a driver in NASCAR, I suspect Driver of the Year is a bigger deal. And it's not fair to Dale Earnhardt Jr. to say this, but if his name was Bob Earnhardt or Frank Earnhardt or Herschel Earnhardt, I don't think he would win this thing 8 years. I do think part of it is the continuing nostalgia for his late father.
This week, the Mets and the Dodgers engaged in an off-season trade, Charlie. And the Mets got who?
Chinlung Hu. Who?
Who's on first?
Chinlung Hu actually plays shortstop.
Oh.
We're going to have to change.
We're
going to have to change the whole routine around. I don't know who's going to have to be on first.
And finally, Charlie, a story that illustrates that all those youth league coaches who tell their players to pay attention during the game, even when they're on the bench, know what they're talking about. As Exhibit A, I give you Tennessee Titans defensive end and concussion victim William Hayes.
Yeah, Kerry Collins overthrew a receiver. The ball went out of bounds and hit William Hayes right in his noggin and knocked him out. All I can say is maybe Kerry Collins was aiming for his wife in the stands.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other books, the Tom Brady one that I mentioned before, and he joins me every week on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
For winning his first professional fight, Joe Louis earned $59. That was in July 1934. Over the next 15 years, he won a great many fights and earned tens of millions of dollars, much of it for people other than himself. More significantly, he became a hero, first to black citizens in the U.S. and then to everyone who needed a surrogate champion to battle the idea of fascism as it had taken hold in Germany. In his new biography of Joe Louis, Randy Roberts explores the mythical status Louis achieved and contrasts it with the reality of the sometimes less than heroic circumstances of his life. Randy Roberts joins me now from WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. Joe Louis found his way into the ring by accident when an amateur boxer, Thurston McKinney, needed a sparring partner. How did that session go?
It didn't go well for Joe at first, but all of a sudden, then Joe connected with a right hand and knocked Thurston down, and Thurston was, he was virtually out on his feet. And Joe Louis discovered that he can hit people really hard, and when he lands a punch, they stay hit.
It's interesting that Thurston McKinney, his first opponent, knew that Louis was taking violin lessons, and his advice was, put that violin away.
The age of the violin ended. He was never much of a violin player. If he had stayed with the violin, I don't think we would have ever heard of Joe Louis.
Years before anybody had heard of Joe Louis, Jack Johnson had proved that a black man could become heavyweight champion of the world. How did it happen that Louis came to assume such symbolic importance for black Americans?
This is an age where black Americans are not achieving a great deal of excellence, and they're not being recognized for the excellence that they're achieving. You take a person like W.E.B. Du Bois, a great black intellectual. His name is hardly even mentioned in the New York Times. There was more written in newspapers about Joe Louis in the 1930s than there was about Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And so here is a person that is a champion. There is nobody better. Joe Louis says to African Americans, you can excel. You can be the absolute best, the best in the world at something.
Louis managed to become the antithesis of Jack Johnson, or at least he was presented to the public that way. He was presented as a happily married man who had nothing to do with white women, which, of course, was part of Jack Johnson's downfall. Yet Louis was unfaithful to his wife. He was an equal opportunity philanderer by all measures. How was it that the illusion of the champ as a clean-cut All-American was maintained?
You know, sports writers in the 1930s and 1940s, they weren't looking to bring down the idols of sports. They were looking to build them up. I mean, this is the age of Grantland Rice, of the Four Horsemen, of, you know, baseball sports writers. They traveled with a team. They ate free lunches. You know, they weren't going to bite the hand that fed them. It won't be until the 1960s that we'll have this new age of sports writers that are interested in bringing down the heroes.
Joe Louis lost to Max Schmeling in 1936. This was not a championship fight. Why did it become such a big deal?
Joe Louis in 1935 and 1936, he fought a succession of ex-heavyweight champions. He fought Primo Carnera. He fought Max Baer. And now he's fighting Max Schmeling, 1936. It was considered it was going to be another easy fight. Max Schmeling comes over. He knocks Joe Louis out. And now suddenly Max Schmeling is embraced by the Nazi regime in Germany. He has lunch with Adolf Hitler. He has tea with Hitler. He watches the Louis Schmeling fight films with Hitler, and Hitler's slapping on himself on his thigh. And so suddenly now this fight, as America and the world is catapulting towards war, this fight takes on real symbolic baggage.
You include in your biography the famous story about the prisoner being executed in the gas chamber who, with his dying breath, shouted, "Save me, Joe Louis." Is that story true, or does it even matter whether it's true or not?
It's probably not true. It was reported by Martin Luther King in a book that Martin Luther King wrote. But it doesn't matter. The symbolic importance is what matters, is the idea that Joe Louis was viewed in the 1930s for African Americans as a savior. Every day he would receive letters from people asking for this or that. They needed money for an operation. They needed money to keep their apartment or house they were living in. Each letter was an echo of, "Save me, Joe Louis, save me, Joe Louis."
Speaking of the requests that he received, he was a generous guy.
Oh, he was overly generous. Joe Louis just frittered money away, gave money away. There's a great story told towards the end of Louis's life. He was a greeter in Vegas, and he was talking with Billy Conn, a great Pittsburgh fighter who he had fought. They had a fantastic fight. And anyway, a guy comes up, panhandles Joe Louis, and Joe Louis has some green chips and black chips. Green chips were worth like $25. Black chips were worth $100. Joe Louis gives the guy a handful of black chips. And Billy Conn says, "Joe, what are you doing? You're being a schmuck. That guy was panhandling you." And Louis says, "Yeah, I know. I was just going to lose it anyway." You know, that's the way Louis treated money. In his prime, he would leave his house in the morning. He might have $300-$400 in his pocket. By noon, he'd be broke.
During the Second World War, Joe Louis, who was already way behind on his taxes, donated purses to the war effort, essentially fought for free. Did his willingness to do that have any impact on his debt to the IRS?
None. Here's this guy, he risks his title twice, once in 1941, once in early 1942. And then he donates all of the money to the government. But the government says, "Look, you know, you owe the tax man." It's like that Beatles song about the tax man. You owe the tax man. Then if you don't pay it back, we're charging you interest. We're charging you whatever we can charge you.
Much has been written about Joe Louis's last years when he began using drugs, survived on the charity of casino owners in Las Vegas, and endured terrifying episodes of paranoia as well. Did you make a conscious choice to limit your consideration of Joe Louis's last decade or so?
Yes, I did. I was interested in Joe Louis in his prime. I was interested in Joe Louis when he meant so much to so many Americans. I didn't want to dwell on the Joe Louis after he retired, the Joe Louis that had the drug problems. I talk about his drug problems, but I don't think there's any need to belabor the point. I don't think Joe Louis, though, at the end, when he was a greeter in Vegas, he never felt sad for himself. You know, he thought being a greeter was a great job. He played golf every day, and he loved playing golf. He had his place to stay on the Caesars grounds. He would gamble with people. He loved talking with people. He was a gregarious guy. And so I don't view the end of Joe Louis's life as particularly sad.
Is it fair to say, regarding those last few years, that he was just very badly served by a country that he had served rather well?
I think so. Suddenly, a new type of black athlete was emerging. You know, proud, defiant, articulate. You know, a person like Jim Brown in football or Muhammad Ali. Joe Louis wasn't that type of an athlete. So it's as if America forgot about him. There's a one great story that Bob Lipsight told me. And it was right before the Sonny Liston-Muhammad Ali fight. And everybody was talking with Muhammad Ali. And all of a sudden, Joe Louis came in. And all the old reporters, the Red Smiths, the famous old reporters, go over to Louis. And afterwards, Lipslight rounded up one of the reporters and he said, you know, why are you going with that old man? The story is right here. It's Cassius Clay at that time. This is the story. And the reporter looked at Lipslight and said, oh, you should have seen him when. The world passed Louis by, but the memory lived on.
Randy Roberts is the author of Joe Louis, published by Yale University Press. He joined me from WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. Randy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I appreciate it and enjoyed it.
Tell the nation the story, let us talk about the brown bomber. Joe Louis was a fine man.
Well, there's Canaris smelling an old bear.
Just like the Battle of Jericho.
John Henry Louis, Jack Dempsey was there.
Way down in Jericho.
He fought Max Smelling the second time.
Just like the Battle of Jericho.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Paul Vikas, Josie Huang, Chris Ballman, Jeremy Bernfeld, and from WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Susan Vallett's Rose Bowl photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from Maine basketball fan Ryan Garrity, who says he's rooting for Antoine Walker's return to the NBA as long as it isn't with Boston.
No, probably not on the Celtics. I liked him when he was a little younger and didn't shoot as much.
Gee, I remember Walker when he was younger, but when he didn't shoot so much? Nah. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Way down in Jericho,
old Peter, Moses, James, and John.
Just like the Battle of Jericho.
Joshua did the battle, and the battle was won.
Way down in Jericho.
Now let us talk about the brown bomber. Tell the nation the story. Let us talk about the brown bomber. Joe Louis was a fighting man.
Support comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. And the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. This is NPR.